I'd like to convene the E12 Education Conference Committee for Wednesday, May 15th. Welcome, everyone. We will start by continuing some of the conversation that was started yesterday on career technical education. We've asked staff from the department to give us that larger contextual overview of what's going on now in Minnesota on career technical education. Ms. Snyder, if you want to lead off the discussion. And members have a copy of a PowerPoint.
They do. Mr. Chair, Caitlin
Ms. Snyder
with the Minnesota Department of Education. First, I'd like to apologize for the commissioner's absence this afternoon. She had a longstanding family engagement that started at 2:30. So she was here briefly, but had to make it over to an event related to her son's graduation from high school this year. I believe the first conference committee hearing, Senator Weber had some conversation with Commissioner Ricker related to career and technical education. So at that point, she reached out to staff to develop some sort of information as follow-up to the interest that she was hearing from the conferees on career and technical education in Minnesota. And then after the conversation the other day, we thought it would be a good opportunity to present some information about what's happening in Minnesota, what's working, what's not working. With me today is Paula Palmer, the Director of Career and College Success. He'll talk some about the work that we're doing at the agency and what we're seeing at school districts across the state. Lastly, before I kick it over to Ms. Palmer, I wanted to apologize because the handout that's in front of you is about 50% complete because I failed to copy the backside of pages, so it's been emailed to you as well. It's in your inboxes should you want to note any items that are missing at this point.
So, Ms. Snyder, I'd remind you that the House position on career technical education is to increase to provide aid to bring the CTE levy up to 50%. So I think if you're hitting 50% on the presentation, you're right about where we'd like you to be.
I appreciate that, Mr.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Ms. Palmer, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Chairs and members, my name is Paula Palmer. I work for the Department of Education as the Director of Career and College Success.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. I was kind of reminiscing a little bit about 6 years ago when I first started this position. I believe Senator Wieger and Mr. Weber were also around the table the first time I ever came, and we were really struggling after the tales of NCLB and trying to address the issues of so many programs, CTE programs that had gone by the wayside by being deprioritized under NCLB. But we have really good news, and that is that we have programs that are really growing, and we're here to talk about that and talk about also what with the Perkins 5 reauthorization is bringing to Minnesota and has to offer us. So I'll just start with some basic foundational information. You can see that there's a definition for career and technical education. It's really bringing the academic and technical skills together and providing opportunities for students to pursue career interests, explore them, and develop them, and also take some very specific classes that develop those technical skills. And in Minnesota, we have we have six fields. You have a color copy of this, so it's a little bit easier to see. So we have programs in all of these career fields, and I won't necessarily read them to you, but what's really exciting now is that we have between secondary and post-secondary, we have almost 250,000 students who are involved in career and technical education. We also have a consortium model, which is unique in Minnesota, and many states are trying to replicate that. We have 26 consortia, and you will recognize your area on this map, that brings together this very the trifecta of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the Minnesota Department of Education, and the local Perkins Consortia, which is made up of districts, schools and districts, as well as an advisory committee with the requirement that at least 50% of that advisory committee is made up of business and industry partners within that. So this isn't just schools or MDE or MnState deciding what programs we have and for which students. It's really led by the local business and industry, and also they help us to keep fresh and relevant, as well as trying to align our programs to local workforce needs. So the program portfolio will look a little different from consortia to consortia because it's specific to providing students experience to explore careers right in their area. And we all like to keep our kids close to us and stay and live in our areas. And many students, most students, want to stay in their communities. So this is a win-win as well as for the employers. I spoke with a gentleman who was just retired from Remley Manufacturing in Big Lake, and they have a beautiful youth apprenticeship program that they've developed for their students, where the students are getting skills and being able to go right into the workforce. And when I was speaking to this gentleman, he was very invested in his community, and it was very clear that to him this was his legacy, and he was very committed to continuing that and also providing youth with opportunities and jobs right out of high school, as well as what they're building is to articulate their youth apprenticeship to state registered apprenticeships as well. So that would be a fun place to visit because they have some really interesting things. And what's unique is they actually had 20 students from outside of their district open enroll in their senior year just to be a part of that youth apprenticeship. And for a small community, that's significant. Then we also have, as not only do we have numbers and participants, but we have some really excellent success stories to tell, not only about programs, but about the individual students. Of the students, this shows you the number of programs that we approved, CTE programs that we have in Minnesota. You'll hear me say approved, and the difference between approved program and or a CTE class or a CTE course is that to be an approved program, the program needs to have a CTE licensed teacher, and it also needs to be a part of this consortia, be a part of a consortia, and be part of have an advisory committee attached to it. So there are classes here and there that schools will offer that might not be part of an approved program, but to be able to access both the Perkins funding as well as the CT levy, which member Chair Dabney mentioned, they have to be an approved program and meet those requirements. And that is critical for sustainability, and we are seeing that that is really the part that helps sustain these programs. Perkins is meant, it's kind of a little drop in the bucket compared to, you'll see statistics, to what the levy generates, but the Perkins is meant to be like seed money, starting new programs kind of money, putting the structures in place where there are no programs or they want to expand. And the levy is really meant to help sustain and cover those costs for teachers and supplies and some equipment. What we are very excited about is this statistic continues to grow. Of our secondary students who participate in CTE, and they're concentrators, meaning they take 240 hours or more, which is roughly about two classes, 92% of those students graduate. So that's a good 10% above the state average. Also, this is about plus 20% over the state average, CTE concentrators enroll, who graduate and enroll in college. Minnesota's average is around 40%. Post-secondary has results, good results too. And I think if you've been following the trends, the completion rate that you see here is far more than what the general post-secondary completion rate is. And then also, who are we talking about?
Senator Nelson.
The last slide, that one that's right there, that's the one we don't have. And just read for me, if you could just read that slide for us.
Sure.
That'd be great. 92%. Yep.
92% four-year graduation rate for all CTE concentrators, students who complete 240 CTE hours within one career field. So they're on a path.
Mr. Chair, and the last bullet point says, if you could read the last bullet point on the right.
For post-secondary?
Yeah.
College students placed or retained in employment by the end of the second quarter following the year they completed a CTE program.
And that's 87%?
87%.
Thank you.
And Ms. Palmer, if you talk really slowly, we'll get full copies of the PowerPoint for members.
Am I talking too fast? And,
oh, yeah. Bingo.
Okay. And then there's that. But we're also getting copies made so that members can follow along.
Right.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer.
Okay. So also what's we would like to share with you is that, so if you want to get a real snapshot of Minnesota, 51% of our students in grade 9th through 12th do take CTE classes. That's how many students are currently accessing CTE in Minnesota. And you can see that of the students that are taking it, when you look at, for example, the Latino or Hispanic students, almost half of them are taking CTE. Almost 42% of our American Indian students are taking CTE. So it's pretty much around 50% of each student group is participating in CTE. And then the percent of 12th graders, 9th through 12th graders who are enrolled in CTE for EL is 60% and 58% for free and reduced lunch and 51% for special ed students. We have roughly 56% of the males are involved and roughly 46% of the females are taking CTE. So many students in Minnesota are accessing CTE. And almost all of our schools have a CTE program or one or more programs. So I did talk a little bit about accessing the levy, the requirements for that, so I don't want to bore you by repeating that. But when you look at this next slide, you can see that the state has generated around $87 million for levy going back directly back to schools to help sustain their programs. And $6 million comes from Perkins. So sometimes people think they see the news big numbers around Perkins, but when it plays out directly to districts in Minnesota, it's only around $6 million. Oh, Perkins, Carl Perkins, is the federal grant that's been around since the 80s, maybe even a little bit earlier, that helps, again, to seed programs, to seed innovation. It frankly, really supports a lot of my staff, probably more about 75% of the staff that we have in Minnesota at the department to help schools with their programming and to meet the requirements and improve programming. Another thing that people are very interested in nowadays is the technical skill assessments and the certifications. While we have a kind of imperfect way of collecting this information right now, roughly in 2018, of the 7,000 tests that were taken, 4,700 of them received a proficient score, so that's roughly 67%. Now, we don't have complete information because our students turn 18 often in their senior year, and many exams report their results directly to the students, and we don't get that. The schools don't get that. So we believe this is an underestimate, but this is what we were able to verify and collect via district reporting. And that is becoming a much bigger part of Perkins 5 coming forward. It will be part of one of the negotiated performance measures. We'll either need to report on TSAs, technical skill assessments and certifications, and or post-secondary credit, or work-based learning participation. So that's a whole nother conversation we would love to have with you, and we're inviting you to that after session because it is a little bit more involved than it has been in the past, but again, that's all good because it's leading us in the right direction for students. So I have many anecdotes, and I'm willing to answer any questions that you might have, but I thought that providing this information would give you a little bit of grounding in the current work right now. One anecdote, I was just speaking with one colleague this morning. Duluth has a Construct Tomorrow program, which means that the students for a whole day are involved in a variety of construction like slices of that industry. And because of the interest, they had to add a whole nother section for all the students that were interested. So we have programs that are growing. We have programs that are pursuing a youth apprenticeship where students are actually on the job a significant amount of time. Sometimes they're even earning a wage. We have Monticello, for example, didn't have any programs, which was kind of an anomaly, but they now have 7 going into 2019-20. We are busy, and that is a good thing because schools are calling us and saying, we want to build programs, we want to expand our programs, our communities are saying we want more. And we also have wonderful examples of how business and industry has contributed a good share of the things that we can't afford as school districts, as far as equipment, mentors, expertise coming into the school and working with the programs on site. So it's a good day for CT. We're very excited about the changes and the growth and the promise that it has for our communities.
Questions from members? Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really exciting to hear. Seen a lot in the few districts I've worked in, too, and all that has to offer. I had had a chance, though, to recently talk to one of our CTE teachers. What are some of the barriers that some districts and communities face in trying to get CTE up and running in their schools?
Ms. Palmer.
Thank you. Some of the barriers are finding teachers. There's a shortage of CTE licensed teachers, so we've been working hard to figure out ways to bridge that in the meantime. Some of the barriers are also just the funds, and the equipment is extremely expensive, and that's why a lot of our business and industry folks have found that it's a win-win for them to help us out with that. That's made a big difference and made it possible for many programs to get started. I think, too, just changing from the four-year college-going paradigm to looking and having parents, actually, there's a big gap in understanding and awareness for parents knowing that two-year degrees can offer really wonderful secure jobs as well as high-paying jobs. And, you know, as we know, about 80-some percent of student decisions for after school is based on and is influenced by parents. We still have a little power, believe it or not. And that makes a big difference. But once they see it, districts that have been very explicit in helping to change that mindset and that paradigm, for example, White Bear Lake, Big Lake, you ask them, what does it take? They say it takes about 5 years, and then the community is all gung-ho and asking for more. So that's probably the mindset challenge aside from resources.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ms. Palmer, I hear. Oh, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to piggyback on what Ms. Palmer said there. I think the changes that were made in the last couple of years as far as teacher licensure has been extremely helpful to the career technical training avenue. I know I have been getting since my appointment to this conference committee, my email box has gotten much fuller. But many of the emails that I have seen are from many of those teachers who, without the tiered system that we have that allows them to get into the classroom, we would just have many programs, particularly in rural Minnesota, that would go wanting, quite frankly. And so that is obviously been one of the primary problems that we have encountered. And partly because we, as the state of Minnesota, some years ago walked away from career technical education in large part. Mm-hmm. And that was the impetus behind the bill that I offered a couple of years ago for a pilot project back in the Southwest West Central Career Education Co-op, and getting that cooperative effort between not only business and MNSCU and schools, but between schools themselves, just because some of the size of our schools can't offer all these different programs. But if they can work out cooperative arrangements between the school districts themselves, and then with the input of business and MNSCU, let's just say this, the first meeting a few years ago went from a meeting of five schools representing 25 students. And today there's over 25 schools with over 600 students. But there are a lot of facets involved in our system, particularly licensing, that are really important for us to keep.
Well, Senator Weber, I think there's the licensing issue. I think there's also the teacher preparation issue, that there's a number of the CTE licensure areas do not have teacher preparation programs in the state. Mm-hmm. So making it so much harder to develop, to recruit and train interested teachers. So there's facets to the issue you raised. Mm-hmm. Ms. Palmer?
Yes, thank you. You read my mind. I was just going to add to the member's question about barriers, and also to piggyback also off of Senator Weber's comments. Teacher pay is an issue. We are looking for experts in these technical fields, and why would, you know, the question they probably ask themselves is, why would I go and work here for this amount when I could go here and work for this amount? For example, our agricultural students, they're scooped up even before they graduate. We have a number of areas where these kids are, like, they're being serenaded even before they graduate. And that is, you know, hard for a young person to resist, and rather than going into the field of teaching. And the lack of teacher preparation is a real problem, because what do? So we appreciate some of the flexibility that the legislature has given us, including the ability to have other entities develop those teacher prep programs. We have a program in the Central Lakes area that is developing both a work-based learning and is going to help with some modules to give teachers that CTE methodology components, so that we could maybe bring some folks from the field in and honor their degree that they have, but then add the pedagogy, the teaching methodology pieces, so that they can become a licensed teacher. So that flexibility has been very helpful, and we appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Sandsteed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, just kind of following up on something that you had just mentioned about, you know, ag, my question for you was going to be, could you highlight a little bit of the innovations or successes, maybe in specific districts or communities that have really built out the workforce needs?
Yeah, so there is a wonderful program that just received an award. St. Paul Como Senior High School just won an Excellence in Action Award for their program, where they not only, I'm sorry, I have to find those in my notes here. I want to make sure that I get this straight for you. They have a business program. And Business Academy of Finance and Business Management, and 90% of these students had a work-based learning experience, which is way above the average of most schools, and 96% of those students who participated earned a post-secondary credit from St. Paul College. So talk about value added as they graduated. They have that work experience, and they have that post-secondary credit. 916 has a business program that's added entrepreneurship flavor to their program, and they nearly doubled their registration in just 1 year. And the teacher brings in this program, they bring at least one small business partner each every week to assist the students in the development of a real business plan. We have construction programs that are growing in White Bear Lake, Duluth, We have them in St. Paul Harding, and they are having to add sections like Duluth just because of the student interest. Hutchinson, Tri-City, United, and Redwood Valley opened new CTE wings in their schools, and each has added new programs and new CTE licensed teachers, resulting in a lot more collaboration across program areas. I was in Burnsville a few weeks ago. They have completely reconfigured their high school to be about career pathways, and they actually have that right as you walk in. You know what that school is all about. And yes, they're growing, but they feel like their community is saying this is what we want. And even in small communities that maybe don't have a lot of businesses, they're a little bit geographically isolated from a lot of businesses, will be really creative. For example, I visited in Morris, Minnesota. That was where I went to college, so I was excited to go back there. And they have all of their 7th and 8th grade teachers do career exploration, so they get a little taste of everything. And even though they only have a few small businesses, they go to that business, and boy, do they exploit the knowledge there. They'll go into the back room to the business side of things, to the marketing side of things, to the design side of things, to the actual construction side of things, to the transportation, like how do you get the product from their business out. So those are some of the creative things that people are doing. Innovative things are also, we are doing more work in trying to help schools integrate academic skills into CTE. Some lend themselves better than others, and we just applied for a great federal grant to hopefully build computer science into the arts, arts into computer science. So there's many innovative things going on in the state, and these are all ideas from the folks who are teaching, are leading, and that is part of what Perkins 5 also does support, is that kind of innovation.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Ms. Snyder.
Thank you. I know that if the commissioner were here, she would also mention the tour that she did in Fairmont over the legislative break and touring some of the programs that Superintendent Joe Brown has talked about in front of this committee.
When this committee went to Waconia, we saw some amazing CTE work there. The lettuce, the egg program with the indoor lettuce under the grow lights that they serve in lunch during the school year, and then in the summer, one of the local restaurants comes in and harvests and purchases the lettuce. As well as the auto shop that they had there and some other aspects. It was pretty remarkable. And I meant Wyndham. Begins with the letter W. Representative Erdahl.
Yes, right.
Begins with the letter U.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let's see, I don't know where to start, because from when I was when I posed my question earlier, you've covered about 10 more topics in your little discussion there. But going back to what I was thinking about, first, when you mentioned agriculture and teachers and the competition there, brought back memories to my teaching days, seeing ag student teachers and saying to them, so are you in here to become a teacher, or are you just going to sell out to the corporations? And most unanimously, they sold out to the corporations. It's hard to blame them. Are you going to start at $38,000 now for a teacher, or $60,000 or something for Cargill? It's not a real hard decision for them to make. But one thing you also mentioned, preparation, and a thought that I've been kicking around for several months now. What would you think of a school year long student teaching program? Using apprenticeships, paid apprenticeships.
Ms. Palmer.
A school year long preparation. Oh, so are you for students or for potential teachers?
Teachers.
Like an externship? So experience?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
Like a student teaching program like we have now.
Mm-hmm.
Only instead of the model we have now, change the model so that they would essentially become apprentices of a teacher and could also receive a stipend or some pay for doing that.
Ms. Palmer, recognizing this might be a larger conversation
yes.
than you came prepared for today.
So I think I understand the question. So back in the day, there were programs like that. There was some funding for teachers to apprentice for a year. So if you're asking my personal opinion, I can tell you my observations of that is that those are some of the finest teachers I've ever seen. I'm old. I've been in this business for 40 years. And most of those teachers have become teacher leaders. So anything to support, incite, or you know, to attract, to better prepare our folks to be teaching in today's classrooms, I'm all for. I thought maybe you were talking about externships where teachers had the opportunity to go work in businesses or observe in businesses also to get that business and industry experience as well. So there's always that, too, that even for those of us who are already in the classroom could maybe go back and learn that side of things.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Snyder?
Commissioner Ricker has also spoken about her desire to have a bigger conversation about how we attract and retain quality teachers and a teacher workforce and what that looks like, what supports we can provide to make sure that teachers are entering the field with the tools that they need to be successful. So I think that this is something that the department is excited about having a conversation about.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you. And that, I've chatted with the commissioner about this a little bit, too. I'm very pleased to hear that. For those senators who don't hear me talking much, or maybe too much, depending on your point of view, I've...
Is that emotional?
Waiting for a minute.
I've made it another one of my little crusades to look to the future and to assert that to be successful in education, we need to prepare teachers better, support them better, and pay them better.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Palmer, thank you for the robust roundup of some of the things that we're doing in CTE. And I think just to add a few comments to some of the things that have been already noted today, I think one of the biggest things is that pendulum swing in parents' expectations about good opportunities for their students. And it's been a long time coming, and it's good to see that parents recognize that there are great jobs, in-demand jobs, that do not necessarily require a bachelor's. And so I think that is a great step in helping us better serve all of our kids and fill our workforce crisis as well. And it's also exciting to, and I think part of that is because our districts have been very responsive in their CTE programs. Career Tech, CTEC, is one that's been highly, highly effective, and it involves great collaborations, and they enroll students from other districts as well. And certainly we've seen the one in Fairmont as well, and actually have passed and proposed legislation to allow those type of innovations to continue. Sometimes, for example, in welding, beyond the school day. So we want to make sure that those students can actually get this type of instruction, and they're not limited to that traditional school day. We've passed legislation that allows ag educators to be actually working with students, well, when the crops are growing, when school might be out of session. So there's a lot of good steps that we have made along the way. And also, I think there's some great potential coming from the feds as well. I do believe that the Perkins 5 reauthorization offers some great options for further innovations and better bridging the gap between K-12 and higher ed. And I think that there are some great opportunities with that as well. And then we need to make sure, however, as you had alluded, as you had said, and as we have heard over and over, at least we heard in the Senate, over and over, the importance of retaining our infant tiered licensure program. It's not quite a year old yet, but to change those tier one particularly, we heard significantly from two specific sectors that would be highly impacted if we gutted that Tier 1 licensure. One we talked about a few days ago, which was teachers of color, and then secondly was our career tech educators. So again, some things need to stay the same, such as that tiered licensure to make sure that we retain all of those opportunities. And then I have a question for you, and if you're not the person to answer, I'm sure that someone at the table here might be able to. So the House proposal, of course, is to increase the CTE expense coverage from the state from 35% to 50%. And my question is, how do we know that that would result in more kids taking CTE? I mean, that's what we want to see. We know it closes achievement gaps, for example. But how do we know that it would result in an increase in CTE programs for students? I mean, it could be the district might just choose to use that funding to close its special education cross-subsidy or something. So I'm just curious, what protections, and maybe you're not the maybe I should be asking our House authors, perhaps. You might not be the best person to answer that. But what I want to know is, how would we know, what are those protections that if in fact that reimbursement were increased to 50%, that it would actually result in more kids getting CTE?
Let's start with Ms. Snyder, because just based on facial.
Yeah. Okay.
It might be helpful if Ms. Palmer talked through what that reimbursement looks like for the approved expenses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ms. Palmer.
Chair, thank you. So it's a reimbursement process. So the expenses have to incur, and they have to be approved via based on their eligibility for reimbursement. So they need to be well documented. We have a system that documents were these CTE teacher salaries, was these CTE expenditures. We look at those very closely before we approve them for reimbursement. So it's not like an upfront funding, it's a reimbursement process. So the 50% reimbursement would only go to eligible appropriate CTE expenditures. We hear from districts that obviously the second largest expense in the district teacher salaries are salaries, all employee salaries are, I believe, Mr. Melcher, the biggest expense, followed by transportation. So districts will say, we want to do some of those programs like that Senator Nelson mentioned, the extended time programs in the summer, out of the school day kinds of programs. We want to add this and that and the other thing, but it is really comes down to, if we do, can we sustain it? And while I can't promise that it'll add to additional students, I believe it will, because it'll take some of the pressure off of the districts to find that funding elsewhere and be able to reinvest that into career and technical education.
Senator Nelson?
Oh, just to follow up on that piece about that question about reimbursement. So mm-hmm. My question wasn't really about eligible expenses. My question was more to the line of a district. What would prevent a district from doing exactly what it's doing now, and because it's receiving a greater reimbursement, then being able to, I think as you alluded to, shift that money somewhere else? I was wondering if Mr. Arneson has any insight on how that possibly could work or not work. What are some of the things we would need to be aware of?
Mr. Arneson. Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Palmer probably described it fairly, the possibilities that a district would have in front of it. The House proposal would increase the reimbursement of the total eligible expense submitted by 15%, and I don't believe that the House proposal assumes any increased expenditures or forecast. For some districts that could result in, plowing that money back into CTE programs, and for other districts that could result in, a reduced general fund subsidy, and reallocating that general fund money to some other purpose.
Mr. Strom, since I'm trusting you know the House proposal.
Madam Chair, I would concur with Mr. Arneson's comments and just say that when it comes to, and you could have individuals from school districts speak to you about this, that we're not carrying a behavioral effect in the House budget line. We're not presuming that districts will run out and immediately spend more on CTE. But the way that school districts do their budgeting is often focused on the line item of money available for that program. So often, if we increase the portion of funding for something like extended time or something else like that, the program area within the district may say, okay, we're getting a bigger amount. This is what we'd like to do with that money. So internal to each district's mentality about how it spends its money, I think it may, in addition to being additional revenue for the district, may make some difference about how they choose to allocate resources. But as Mr. Arneson says, we're not carrying an inflationary effect on spending, presuming that will drive spending higher. That may be a logical thing to conclude, but we're not building that in our number.
Senator Nelson?
Just kind of a follow-up question. Something that I think deserves some discussion that I'd like to just kind of pause it there and think about. One, we're highly supportive of CTE. It has tremendous results, both in graduation rates, closing achievement gaps, all of those things, providing workforce. So highly supportive of that. The question I have is, first of all, I assume those reimbursements would include equipment, because CTE equipment, in some cases, some of that equipment is very expensive, and that could have been one of the reasons that years before I think any of us got here, we kind of moved those out of our schools, our high schools particularly, and our middle schools, and kind of move them into community colleges, because that equipment is so expensive. And I just want to, so the reimbursement would also reimburse that very expensive equipment.
Ms. Palmer?
Some of the equipment expenditures are eligible. Mm-hmm. Also, to follow up a little bit with your question before, I don't have hard evidence. I'm looking at Mr. Melcher of the formula for the levy has changed. It changed in 2013-14, and I believe that most districts saw an increase in the reimbursement when that change was made. So while I can't prove this, the fact that we've grown programs with that change may indicate that another change may also incentivize growth as well.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. And just to follow up on that equipment, one of the things that, because I've definitely contemplated this, as I know my colleagues have too, and so one of the challenges that I think we have is that oftentimes the equipment is extremely expensive. $1 million piece of equipment is not unusual. $250,000 is pretty, you know, standard. So it's a very expensive equipment. And experience leads me to believe that we keep that equipment for a long time. It's very expensive. And when our schools invest in that and their resources are always stretched thin, we keep that equipment for a long, long time because it's very expensive. And the challenge is, oftentimes, we live in a highly innovative age where what was cutting edge equipment a year ago is suddenly passé. And so my instinct is that we just don't have the resources to keep up with that constant churn of necessary new equipment, because it's highly expensive. And we want our kids, though, learning on the cutting-edge equipment that is going to prepare them for those jobs. And so one of the things that we've looked at is, however, on the other side of the coin, the industries, they do have to update that equipment in a much more, in a much faster rotation than our public schools do. And so I think that we just have to consider that there might be a better way to make sure that our kids are actually getting that great CT education, but it seems like a very costly proposal if we are expecting our schools to invest in that very expensive equipment that we know is going to be around for 20 years, well after its lifespan. And so I think that's just a question that I put out there for thought.
Chair Dabney, may I respond to that? So one of the things that we have seen also is that that's part of the impetus behind increasing youth apprenticeships and work-based learning, because we get the students right there with that cutting edge, not to mention the employability skills that they're learning by being on the job and learning how to what's work like. You know, work is very different than going to school every day and developing those skills so they're much more ready. So to your point, we did in 2013 an equipment inventory. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, that was the top concern, is keeping up with equipment and safety. Safety requirements. Our buildings were not made for passing OSHA requirements today. So, yes, that is a very real problem. So I would anticipate that districts would be very happy to know that they had a little more resources to invest in where it makes sense, or invest in youth apprenticeship, work-based learning experiences for their students.
Thank you.
Ms. Palmer, I haven't had the opportunity to visit the Burnsville programs, but my understanding is that one strategy that they've employed, to Senator Nelson's concern about the cost of equipment, is working with local industry, partnering with them, and then it becomes in the industry's interest to help support the purchase or donation of up-to-date equipment. Can you respond? Are you seeing school district business collaborations along that line?
Absolutely. In my little town of Rockford, anybody know where that is?
Mm-hmm.
in our schools just started a manufacturing CTE program, and our area businesses were like, we're happy to give you this equipment because, to your point, we have to buy new equipment 5 minutes after we buy the old equipment. So they were happy to donate that, and that is why we were able to start manufacturing in Rockford, which is a small district as well. Yes, that's critical, and districts are happy to do that, or businesses are often very happy to do that.
And then, Ms. Palmer, I'll try to bring it to a close here, but you've used a couple of terms, Pathway, mm-hmm. Academy. Mm-hmm. I don't quite understand synonyms, perhaps, or not, mm-hmm. But I guess what I'm wondering about is the connection not just between the school and the industry, but between the K-12 school and the higher education institution. Because I'm aware some of that goes on, but could you speak to how do we move students from CTE experience at the high school level to post-secondary?
Mm-hmm. Chair?
Please.
We have, as part of our programming and our state-approved programs, we also have, we loosely call them pathways, but we have we have programs that clearly articulate from K-12 to post-secondary partners, and we call those programs of study, POS, another acronym. And those are programs that a student could start in high school, and they know that they could continue on that career pathway to that through that post-secondary partner. But we don't require all of our approved programs to be programs, very articulate programs of study, because not all districts have post-secondary partners that are close enough that they would know their students would be attending. So we can't really hold them accountable to that requirement. And then we have rigorous programs of study, which mean that articulated pathway from post-secondary to secondary to post-secondary has some sort of credential or certification at the end of it. So it's a complicated world for sure in career technical education, but we are promoting programs of study because we believe that that's a good use of student time and our resources, as well as has that end game in mind, whereas it is that student is receiving a degree or some sort of certification at the end of it.
Thank you. Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things. In those situations when businesses do donate to a program, is the school in any way penalized, I mean, in terms of qualifying amounts through the levy credit? Anyway.
Ms. Palmer?
Chair, not to my knowledge, it would be no penalty.
And then, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess the other item I would mention, I think what we've seen in our area is that perhaps for career advancement, I think one of the probably the most common occurrences is where you have a student that perhaps was pursuing through draftsman work and that type of thing, and actually decides to go on and become a full-fledged engineer, or you have someone that gets their CNA and all of a sudden decides to go further in the medicine field and that type of thing. So I think, and probably because they have that preliminary introduction is what sort of cemented their desire to go forward in that particular area. And I think that's probably one of the greatest benefits for those students, getting that taste before they make this all-out commitment that someday they may come to regret and can't afford.
Well, I often say that, for instance, a two-year degree can be a period or a comma, which I think is what you're alluding to as well. For some people, it's that taste, and then they move on. And for some people, it's the terminal degree because they're happy where they are. Ms. Plummer, did
Chair
you want Dabney, to respond?
Thank you. To your point, I've learned from my adult basic education teammates is that there's a tipping point, and when people have that taste, when they have that little bit of something, either certification or credits, post-secondary credit, they are much more likely to pursue a pathway and complete and actually get to. There's studies that show that if we can get them to that tipping point, they actually attain a family-sustaining wage. It's just getting them there over that place. So that is a very important part of this. And that's why we stress that value added of credit and credential as much as possible, and I believe why Perkins 5 is really prioritizing that.
And referring to Perkins 5, are we in a planning year? So can you just speak a little bit more to that, and then we'll go to Senator Weger.
Chair Dabney. Yes, we are in the planning year. It's a lot of work, very exciting. So we've been holding a stakeholder focus group feedback meetings around the state in collaboration with MnState. So we're trying to get as much feedback as possible to inform that planning. And again, the commissioner would like to extend an invitation to all of you to visit with us about where we are at with that. And yes, so then we're in the planning to plan year. So then we will submit a transition plan to the full four-year Perkins 5 plan, and that's revisited every 4 years. And a part of that is that we do monitor our schools and districts, how they're spending their money, how they're planning, and we approve their consortia plans. And the consortia plans are meant to benefit every district in the consortia. So it's not a school-by-school plan under Perkins. So it is about that whole shared interest and benefit, and then as it fits in underneath our whole state plan.
Thank you. Senator Weger.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Palmer, thanks for your 40-plus years of service and leadership.
Thank you.
Quarter of a million students' success. So
thank you.
That's outstanding. We talked about the challenges recruiting, retaining teachers, and I don't think we've had any discussion about counselors. Mm-hmm. And could you comment on that? Because of the exposure early on, we mentioned about parents, very importantly, being involved, but the skill set and availability of counselors for their important role in this equation.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Palmer.
Yes, thank you. So we do have counselors, but we're pretty much at the bottom of the nation for our ratio of student to counselors. We are at like 450 students per counselor. There are some schools that don't have counselors. We did have a great grant to help incentivize that. I think we just overall have a shortage of just even available counselors. But then there's also the career advising side of that. So counselors are often in schools so busy with the mental health issues, with the day-to-day workings of a school, the career advising is not always prioritized. In 2013, the legislature passed the personal learning plan, which is a requirement that all students no later than grade 9 have a plan that involves looking at what courses they should be taking, looking at their career interests, looking at what kinds of rigorous opportunities they're having. So yes, that I would say that career advising side of things, as well as the counseling side of things, is to your point, definitely a challenge, and we have a shortage of that. But I would, I housed with counselors for 3 years, and they want to make sure they. One thing I learned from them is there's two sides to that job, and that is the mental health, you know, side of things, and then also the career advising, which very few schools have any counselors that are committed to just career advising. So it's up to all of us to figure out ways to provide students with that mentorship and that advisement.
Senator Weaver?
No, Ms. Chair, the challenge is before us. So.
Yes. Representative Pinto.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
It's one person each day.
It's all good. I don't know if now is the right time to do this, but I would find it helpful to get a review of the House and Senate proposals with respect to this issue, maybe just my ignorance and being relatively new to this overall topic. But I think that might be really helpful if we could just get a reminder kind of what the respective sides are doing with respect to CTE, either now or whenever appropriate.
I think we can come back with a full, as we have a number of different things in different places, so I think we can come back with that for you. The one thing I would say is, as we all know, as we're sitting here waiting for our leaders to get those joint budget targets, so much of what we will do, and we hope soon, will be so largely dependent upon what those joint budget targets are. But we'll be glad to pull together the CTE provisions that live within our existing revenue. That's where the Senate target is. Does not include any sort of tax increases. We'll be glad to get that in a nice little document for you.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. For the House side, we see this as kind of a larger context of building varied bridges to post-secondary. So as was referenced earlier, we propose aid for CTE expenses, reimbursement of CTE expenses, to take that reimbursement rate from the 35% local levy to 50% in total, with the aid being the difference between the 35% and 50%. That's $12.5 million over the biennium. Then, again, to the varied bridges, increasing the funding for concurrent enrollment classes. You may recall that the statutory reimbursement is $150 a student a class for concurrent enrollment courses. We actually reimburse less than $50 a class per student, so we're well below the statutory authorization there. So we propose a $6 million increase in that area. Again, we didn't build in behavioral changes, as Mr. Strom referenced with the CTE, but we would hope that this would include districts then expanding their dual enrollment opportunities, concurrent enrollment opportunities. And then we have two provisions related to early middle college to catch those students and help them move into post-secondary. And those are relatively significantly smaller dollar amounts. There's one has no cost attributed to it, and the other $136,000. So, certainly. So, looking at varied bridges to post-secondary, you know, you'll often hear that a budget is a moral document. I'm not willing to go quite that strong. You think you can have one pass along? I'm not willing to go quite that strong, but it does send a message to students and families and communities that we value career technical education when the state steps forward and invests more in career technical education. And I know from talking with educators and the business community, what they want is the state to send more of a signal that we value students who are taking career technical education courses and who see their path into adulthood along that walk as well. So we see these as important investments for Minnesota students. Back to you, Representative Pinto. I'm sorry, we bird-walked off of your question.
No problem. And I know that we're going to be getting targets at some point here, and of course so much will be dependent on that, to Chair Nelson's point. But it does seem really helpful to know, because each side as it came in was dependent on the targets it was given, but we do have a sense of prioritization in terms of how we chose to spend it. I do have a question, maybe when the Senate is pulling it together, about line 47 on the spreadsheet that references the Rural CTE Consortium grants. And I mean, this may have been answered earlier when we were doing the run-through, but there's $6 million that actually comes back in the upcoming biennium. And so just wanted just a reminder about what that's about, again, at the appropriate time.
Senator Nelson, you have a response.
Oh, yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have our fiscal folks go through your final question there.
Thank you.
But just to kind of give you a quick run-through, obviously the Senate has been a huge supporter of all post-secondary enrollment options, dual enrollment, career tech education. We talked about some of those things that we've done in the past. Some of the things that you'll see in the Senate bill are we provide enrollment options, transportation. One of the more difficult things is for some of the students who want to get to those CTE programs that could be at their junior college, perhaps. We provide a transportation for that, increased transportation for that. We also increase PSEO options for 10th graders so they can take CTE. Currently, they cannot. And so that, again, is in the Senate bill. For the non-public schools, for all of our students. We also have vocational enrichment grants for things like I mentioned, like the welding, for example, at Fairmont, that actually is when a school is not in session. So we want to make sure that we allow funding for that, even though it is not during the regular school day. And then, of course, we had some discussion about PTEC, which is that innovation that kind of takes the best of PSEO and concurrent enrollment and marries that with our higher education, and then that industry partner that provides that apprenticeship, mentorship, internship, and that kind of that pathway that we talked about. And so speaking to that pathways that we did for career planning in 2013, actually that was my legislation. It only went through, grade 12, because that's what we are. But PTEC actually expands that, obviously, into grades 13 and 14 as well, and ends in that first in line for a job in those high-demand, high-pay careers. We also have construction and skilled trades being added to the career planning path. And also then one of the things that we have found particularly, there's a huge workforce crisis in many areas, particularly in our construction careers. And again, those are high-paying careers. And so one of the challenges has been that we don't currently allow students to get any hands-on experience in the construction field. We don't know, we have the Senate also, in addition to having that as part of the career planning path, we also have funded our commissioners, our Dolly commissioner and our education commissioner, to look and study and provide us with a joint report about how could we safely and, of course, following all OSHA requirements and all of those important things. But really, how could we safely look at allowing our kids to have some sort of hands-on experience in construction careers? And so that is in the Senate bill. And, of course, I already talked about how we are funding ag educators. And then another Senate provision, which necessarily isn't in the education bill, but again gets to the importance of career tech education and innovations in industry partners and higher education as well. There's a project called Bridges to Healthcare over in the Jobs Bill that's sitting in the Senate Omnibus Jobs Bill, which is remarkable in that it takes high school kids from all over and provides them with bridges to health care, where as they spend a half a day at a particular site, they have some options, some of those pathway options, whether it be a CNA, a pharmacy, tech, and then there's a couple other ones as well that when they graduate, they are ready to take those tests and earn those certifications. So we are doing a lot, certainly as a state, need to do more. And the Senate bill has a wide variety of ways that we can encourage and know that we're going to see more career tech options for our kids.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know. I may have missed the explanation on that, the $6 million in the upcoming biennium. And maybe
we're
you did
ask
say that.
The fiscal folks for that.
Ms. Hoffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto. In the Senate bill, there is funding for the Rural CTE Consortium grants through the fiscal year 2021 biennium only. It is not included in base funding for fiscal years 2022 and later.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm understanding right, so the base funding, so essentially it was $6 million was taken away then from the base funding, and that second biennium was just the decision was made in order to fit in the targets on the Senate side.
Ms. Hofer? Or Senator Nelson?
Not exactly.
Okay.
Actually, it was one of those mistakes in the final rush to get things finished. They were intended to be pilots to get things started, and they were not intended to be ongoing. So in 2017. So they were, so we gave them the tails, but did not expect them to be continued on into the base budget.
Right.
Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm understanding then that it was the original intent was that the funding would simply run through 2021. There was an earlier mistake such that it would appear that the funding would continue in the base. That was not intended, and you said that you're simply going back to that original intent.
Yes, as the pilots to get started, and they've been quite successful.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess I assume then the House position, and I just not track this, since we don't have a corresponding $6 million, is to continue those rural CT consortium grants into the 2022-2023 biennium. And so I'm just understanding the House position as a House member. Mm-hmm. Am I correct about that, Mr. Chair, or maybe for our staff?
Ms. Adrians, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto. That's correct. The House bill continues the funding for the rural CTE consortium grants at the base level, which is $6 million for the biennium.
Representative Pinto?
All right, thank you. Senator Nelson.
And just to note, that was a Senate provision. I think it originally came across at $3 million, but we were so enamored that we did double the funding for that so we could see more of those pilots. And I think we've seen that, and they've been highly successful.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like the House is even more enamored. That's word. Continue on. Thank you.
Ms. Palmer, closing comments? Representative Joaquin, I'm sorry, before your closing comments.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, probably could be like OPE too, but I just wanted to make sure I had a full picture here. So I do still get concerned about the continuity of having an approach where we just stick money in for pilots to get things started and not have anybody there to hand the baton off to. But is there anything right now in our statutes or laws that would prohibit a business or industry partner from collaborating with a high school or a post-secondary institution? And kind of in that aspect too, what type of post-secondary agreements are out there right now with partners that exist in collaboration with a high school or school?
Ms. Palmer?
Thank you. Oh, there's quite a variety of agreements and collaborations. We are seeing one program you might be familiar with is, for example, High Step Academy in the Mankato area, where we have six districts collaborating to they built a health career program, and they collaborated with their local hospital. They collaborated with a college in the area. They are also using blended online to deliver some content as well as classrooms, and this is a miracle in itself. The six districts synchronized their schedules so that it would allow students to transition to and from these different areas. So the students are actually getting the workplace experience as well as the post-secondary experience, and they're leveraging those post-secondary students in healthcare to help mentor the students. So that's an example of a very creative collaboration. We have, I believe, in... IBM is helping with a construction program in, I just had this written down this morning, where they are also the contributing resources for that to happen for the students. So it's kind of an interesting collaboration. Like I mentioned, Big Lake has their manufacturers in the area have agreed more and more every year. They had one partner when they started 5 years ago, and now they have many partners, and they're actually seeing businesses coming to them asking, can we be a part of it, that will agree to have the students in the workplace. These collaborations take time to grow. Obviously, the trust between the schools and the businesses to protect their interests takes time to establish. There really are no barriers other than the willingness to do it and to give it a go. We just did a documentary with our research partners and TPT, Twin Cities Public Television, that highlighted some programs in rural Minnesota where their businesses are helping build an entrepreneurship program for some of their students, and also a summer health camp for the students where the students are in the health facilities and experiencing all those different types of jobs that are in a hospital. There's hundreds of them. I was in Princeton where the businesses in the area agreed to have the teachers visit and do a little job shadowing and learn more about their businesses, and then those teachers went back, and in their professional development time, they actually figured out planned ways to integrate that information into their core content. So there's a lot of creative things going on. There really aren't any barriers. It's just taking the time to do it.
Representative Youakim.
Thank you. It really does sound like it is very successful, and that there's not. It doesn't sound like. I'm hearing no, there's no real things in statute that prohibits people to do this. So we're really using innovation and incentives to really drive those results up there. So that's fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Palmer, any closing comments?
Just thank you for this opportunity. And again, remember the commissioner's invitation will be coming. And we look forward to speaking with you more about Perkins 5. It's a game changer for our students.
Very good. Thank you very much for the time today.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. Thank you, Ms. Snyder, as well. Let's check with her.
Ms. Caitlin prepared the
She was yesterday.
Okay.
Just didn't get too much.
All right. Sure. Ms. Snyder? Yesterday we did not get to some of the conversation on American Indian, supporting for American Indian teacher preparation. And I believe you were prepared to respond to help us with that. Is that still the case?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Caitlin Snyder, Minnesota Department of Education, in case that's necessary. So based on conversation from Monday evening, the department reached out to the tribal nations to get some feedback on the Senate position on the Minnesota Indian Teacher Training Program language. We heard back from six of the tribal nation partners. So we heard back from the partners on the Tribal Nations Education Committee representing Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, Boise Fort, the Greater Minnesota member, and the Prairie Island Indian Community member. All six of these members were in opposition to the Senate language that would limit the, or that would prioritize granting scholarships to the associate's and bachelor's degree students. They are in support of the language that would allow the grantee institutions to make those decisions based on what the application pool looks like. I also have information. I have three handouts available if the pages would assist. The first handout is related to the Minnesota Indian Teacher Training Program. There was a question about the breakdown of how the past participants have, what their current participation in education looks like. This is a pool of data that was done from 1999 to 2018 participants in the Minnesota Indian Teacher Training Program. What this data pool looked like was a lot of hand phone calls, so calling through past grantees, calling through past schools. And part of the reason, to circle back to Senator Nelson's point about the need for better data, is that it hasn't been MDE's practice to collect the file folder number of the teachers that are trained through this program, through Grow Your Own program, through Pew Grants. And that's a conversation that we're having currently about, is that necessary to track the performance of these teachers through the rest of their career so that we can have better information, but does that abut on some data privacy concerns? So because that hasn't been current practice, it took a lot of hand pulling of information and literally calling school districts to see where these teachers are now. So based on that 20 years of data, of the 134 Minnesota Indian teacher training participants, 47 are currently licensed in the STAR system. In addition, 81 of the participants are working in another educational capacity of some sort. So they could be teaching Ojibwe language and culture through the University of Minnesota. Some are Indian education teachers. Indian education directors. Members may know that under 124D.76, any school district that has more than 100 American Indian students is required to have an Indian education director. So it's possible that these participants, once they were employed as an Indian ed director, no longer maintained their teaching license. 150 districts statewide are required to have the Indian ed directors. Other information that is being passed out to the committee currently are follow-up information from the Ethel Curry American Indian Leadership Scholarship. So this scholarship is currently taking applications. Thank you very much. It is currently taking applications. We're in the application window now through May 31st. This is an endowment based on a generous donor that wanted to provide scholarships to American Indian students in the state. It's somewhat different. It's largely different than the Minnesota Indian Teacher Training Program because it's focused on students that are pursuing any sort of education. So some of the majors that are currently awarded scholarships through the Ethel Curry Scholarship include American Indian Studies or Nursing or Marketing or Community Health. So fantastic pursuits, but not limited to teachers. There's also information being passed out about what the current participation in the Ethel Curry Scholarships look like, what those award amounts are. And I should note for the committee that there's also an Ethel Curry Scholarship through the University of Minnesota, but they're managed differently and have different application criteria.
Ms. Snyder, looking at the handout of the Minnesota Indian Teacher Training Program, that last bullet that you touched on, with 95% of participants continuing in education, that strikes me as a remarkably high number. Do you have, it, even just informally, any comparison against other grant recipients? You know, it's someone similarly situated but not a recipient of this grant, what the retention rate is? Because 95% is kind of hard to beat.
That is, Mr. Chair, that's a very good question. The Minnesota Indian Teacher Training Program is one of the longer teacher recruitment grants that the state has had, so I would hesitate to compare it to a Grow Your Own grant that's been only around for a fewer number of years. But we know from the most recent teacher supply and demand report from Pelsby that only about half of our currently licensed teachers are working in education. So this is a broader definition of working in education, to be clear, but we know that teacher recruitment is a concern across all areas.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry we didn't get to that yesterday, but I'm so appreciative of the information today. I think that's good for us to know. And really greatly appreciate the Ethel Murray Scholarship for our American Indian students to pursue whatever avenue is important. And quite frankly, I did not know about that Ethel Murray Scholarship until Rep Pinto and I were serving on the, I think it was called Excellence in Education Board. But we clearly have more work to do here. Looking at 128 participants over 10 years, so 95% is good to have 95% in education. We'd like to see more teachers, but to think that's only 12.8 per year. So clearly there's more work to do here. So thank you, Ms. Snyder.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering who, and I was looking for this, for the language in the bill, or Article 3, okay. But a question, so who decides, so setting aside the prioritization and statute, what is the body that decides who receives these, the teacher training grants? Kind of, is there a review body within the department? I'm just wondering if Ms. Snyder knows. Or
Ms. Snyder?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, you're referring to the Minnesota Indian Teacher Training Programs, correct?
Yeah.
There are four named grantees under statute that if I try to recite, I'm going to mistake one of the four named grantees. But I can send that information around. So the four grantees are awarded the funds. There's language in the Senate, House, and Governor's bill that would allow the grantees to also contract with tribal institutions if a student wants to stay closer to home. So the what happens is the grantees work with their local tribes and their local school district is the setup in statute.
Yes. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess, but if there are more students who are applying or more funding that's needed and is available for each of the grantee institutions, do they maybe then have an internal review committee of some kind that decides we're going to choose these fund these students at these amounts and those students those amounts and these students not at all? Or
Ms. Snyder?
Mr. Chair, those decisions would happen at the grantee level versus at the Department of Education. I should note that there was a sizable increase in the funds in the 2016 legislative session. So hopefully that's not been an issue.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I would assume, though, they must have to make some sorts of decisions that that there's the that there's not funds to cover 100% of the students, because otherwise, I guess that implies in some circumstances there's actually more funds than is needed, and I guess I find that kind of hard to believe. So I assume that there must be decisions made within the grantee institutions as to.
Mr.
Snyder.
So language that's carried in both bodies in the governor and lieutenant's budget bill also includes prioritization based on the definition of American Indian. So this language was negotiated with the tribal nations and the department and the grantees. So I'm imagine it's in Article 3 as well, but there's prioritization based on if you're tribally enrolled, if you're descended from tribally enrolled, based on that definition. But there's not, that I'm aware of, in statute prioritization apart from that.
Okay. And Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So finally, the reason I'm asking that is because I am remembering back to it's the Minnesota Academic Excellence Foundation that that Chair Nelson and I served on, and I remember some of the decisions, and you can see it in the spreadsheet we have, that graduate and doctoral students are more expensive. Mm-hmm. It's a higher award, and I remember some difficult decisions. But it does make sense to me that you would have whatever committee or group that's deciding is going to be looking at individual student circumstances and deciding how to allocate the funds, and sometimes would make sense to fund a graduate student versus undergrad, et cetera. I guess especially if our tribal nations are telling us that their preference is to not make the prioritization of undergrads versus graduate students. I guess I would put a lot of weight on that. And I'm thinking back to the Ethel Curry work that Chair Nelson and I did, where in fact there was not that prioritization, and we were free to figure that out, to take the funds that were available and make the best decisions that we could on behalf of the students and going on from there. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Snyder?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a great follow-up question that I should have dug into prior to today, but I can reach out to the grantee institutions and see how those decisions are made at the site level.
Thank you. Any other questions from members for Ms. Snyder on this topic? All right. Oh, Senator Nelson.
One more. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you're looking at that, Ms. Snyder, also kind of give us an idea about really what the demand is. How many applicants or unfilled. So along with that prioritization, also, what is the demand? Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Members, we'd now like to, let's see, I'm wanting to make sure I've got page one. There's a document coming around. I've already got one. Dated items for discussion, Wednesday, May 15, 2 p.m. Number of articles primarily from the House.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Weaker, yes.
Mr. Chair, we have a document, but it's dated May 14.
The May 15 document is coming around to you now. Yeah. And we would like to take this as an opportunity to walk through some of the provisions in the House bill, although some of them are also found in the Senate bill as well. Allow people to shuffle for a moment.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's my issue. I need a big screen.
Something in this room. I seem
to have been caught. That's good. Okay. Senator Nelson. Thank you. Does I-90 go through? Border to border. I didn't realize.
It's cheaper than the ring.
It is cheaper than the ring.
They're not.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that would make sense.
But it's a wonderful flavor. And they only do the so they bring it in because it's an Irish thing. And then you just like we can sort of look at these sessions for an hour or so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So for folks following along at home, that was an opportunity for members of the audience to get the same list of largely technical, non-substantive policy changes that we're wishing to discuss this afternoon and this evening. Starting on the top of page one, excuse me, on page R3 of Article 1, Ms. Pera, Mr. Sprom, who's best to walk us through the absence from school for religious observance provision?
Mr. Chair, I'll walk through those.
Thank you.
In Article 1, Section 5, page R3, The House requires a district to provide annual notice to the parents of a district policy and of students' observance for, I'm sorry, absence for religious observance, and that notice can be provided on the website or in the student handbook. In Article 1, Section 6, allows the school board to consider the community's religious observance when determining the school's calendar, the annual calendar. And then moving on to Article 3, Section 58 on page R47. That's a long one, so hold on. The actual change is on page R48 on lines 151.35, and it requires the commissioner to provide the investigative file and a determination of maltreatment that involves a board's licensee, so Pelsby or BOSA licensee. The commissioner would have to provide that file to the board, not including student identifying information. Section, then moving on to Article 4, on Section 2, page R1, that's the section amending individualized education programs, and if you go to the change in paragraph B, it allows an individualized, an IEP team to eliminate benchmarks or short-term objectives unless it's a student who takes alternative assessments. The other language that you see that's not highlighted there is also on the Senate side, but that part about the benchmarks or short-term objectives is not on the Senate language.
Mr. Arneson, do you want to go to the Senate provision? Is that appropriate at this time?
Mr. Chair, I certainly can. The companion Senate provision on the first page of Article 4, Section 1?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Mr. Chair, the Senate language is essentially in two parts. In paragraph B, the Senate proposes the same language as a portion of the language proposed by the House in paragraph B. And in paragraph D at the bottom of page R3, the Senate has a similar proposal related to the functional behavior assessment authority, except that the Senate also provides that a parent may request that a school district conduct a comprehensive evaluation.
Okay. Does anyone have questions?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Nelson.
Just to back up a second.
Oh,
I have a question on House Article 3, Section 58. Mm-hmm. And I just want to know, what is the intent there? Is it which licensing boards, all licensing boards? Can we get some clarification on what the intent is there? And that is on R47 of Article 3, so members can take a look at that.
Thank you very much, Senator. Ms. Perro, can you
Mr. Chair, members. So it requires the commissioner, if the commissioner is investigating maltreatment involving a person who works at a school facility, and that person is licensed by a board or other agencies, so that could be all the persons who are licensed by Pelsby or BOSA. Some folks who work in schools have other licenses. They might have a nursing license or, you know, some other license. So any board or agency that licenses a person that works in a school facility would get a copy of the maltreatment determination report, but without the student identifying information. And those agencies could then use that information to for their own investigations, determinations with respect to their licensing actions.
So, Senator, as I understand this, is it's to allow the investigation to occur, a report to be generated, but protect the privacy of the student who allegedly was involved. I'm not quite sure the language, but protect the student's privacy and
thank
identity.
You. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Determination of maltreatment is that language. But I would just, I don't necessarily have an opinion on this, but I do think there's some clarification that's needed here, because to say that involving an individual performing work within a school facility who is licensed by a board or other agency, we should maybe know what that is. I mean, is that the someone with the boiler's license? I mean, there's all kinds of licenses and boards and all types of boards mm-hmm. that individuals represent or are parts of within our school system. And I just want to know kind of what's the scope.
Mm-hmm. So, Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So so to confirm, this is language which is in current law and would not be affected by the change. So we wouldn't that idea about how broad mm-hmm. the scope of the board or other agency wouldn't be affected by any of this. And I would assume that we would want that to be interpreted as broadly as possible, because somebody who's working in a school who's licensed by a board or other agency, we want to make sure if there's some record of maltreatment, we want to know that and have that be communicated. But in any case, again, it's not that part isn't being affected. What we're trying to do, seems to me anyway, is to both to spell out the information to be provided. Right now it's just the phrase necessary and relevant information. We want to make sure that every bit of information that's needed is transmitted. But what's not transmitted is any student identifying information, because we don't want to have our students' privacy be compromised. And so that really is, it seems to me anyway, the goal of this change, which makes a lot of sense.
Ms. Perro?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, to echo what Representative Pinto was saying, the change in here is a clarification of what information is required to be provided to the licensing entity. So it's striking out necessary and relevant information to be more specific about what information has to be provided, for example, a summary of findings, determination, et cetera.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is just gets to my point exactly. So it is the point of the protecting the privacy of the students. Mm-hmm. And the intention, I believe, should be to keep all of our kids safe. Mm-hmm. And they do. The point is they interact with a number of different adults in our schools. And they are represented by a number of different boards and other agencies. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions on this provision or any of the provisions we'd previously covered? All right. Ms. Pera, I believe we're on Article 4, Section 16. Am I correct?
I believe
13,
that's...
13, I think.
Oh, 16. Mr. Chair, yes. Section 16 is on page R13 of Article 4. And that requires the Commissioner of Education to appoint a working group to improve alignment between state and federal requirements with respect to the prior written notice that goes in the IEP. Article 5,
Ms. Perra, one moment. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out with that one in the Section 15 that was language worked out between PACER and the school districts.
Any other questions? All right, Ms. Perra, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Article 5, Sections 4 and 5 relate to the administration of drugs and medicines in school.
Mm-hmm.
And these relate to the storage of medications, information that parents has to provide to the school, also the transport of medications and disposal of unclaimed medications.
Questions on that? I know that there's been discussion in the House about
medications in students, and this gets into a thornier area about the classes, I guess, is the appropriate terminology, of medications that some students are on, depending on their medical needs, and how to responsibly deal with those leftover medications when a student either leaves the school or the school year ends. Ms. Pera, please continue.
Mr. Chair, Article 8, Section 3 is on page R3. Am I looking at that right? I'm sorry, page R1. And this section clarifies that the change you'll see is on page R2, line 230, 12, and 13. And it clarifies that the assessments used, the screenings have to be age appropriate. And on page R3, Article 8, Section 5, this relates to the VPK application or administration. Currently, there are four regions, and Minneapolis and St. Paul are one region, and this would split them up into two regions. It would not affect current funding for any of the recipients of VPK funding.
And Ms. Pera, am I correct that the provision you just spoke to in Article 8, Section 3, as well as this one in Article 8, Section 5, were in the 2018 bill that passed off of both floors?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's right.
All right. And what about the following ones? Or I guess my request would be, if these have already passed both floors last year, would you please identify that to the best of your memory?
Yes.
Thank you.
Sure. And then, so on that note then, both the drugs and medicines ones I just went through in Article 5, those are both in the 2018 bill.
Thank you.
Senator
Nelson.
Thank you. One question before we leave that. On the voluntary, let's see, I think it splits the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts into separate areas. I think I've heard it called pots of money, but different areas. And why is that important? What are we trying to get at there? And I think that's on R3.
Sure. Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, it wouldn't change the amount of money that goes, amount of funding that goes out to fund VPK programs statewide or to Minneapolis-St. Paul as a whole. What it does is that it separates them out. You know, the funding is allocated based on poverty levels at the different sites. Mm-hmm. And so this way, my understanding is, and I guess I'll look to research to assist, and a reminder, this passed both floors last spring, that allows for there to be funding that would go to both of the city's school districts as opposed to necessarily being driven by one versus the other if there's sort of more poverty in the one versus the other areas. But maybe House Research just confirmed that I've gotten that right.
Mr. Strong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Daphne, yes, the part of it's a distributional issue. Minneapolis and St. Paul both have relatively large number of low-income buildings that serve low-income students, but the very, very top of the distribution was more heavily tilted toward Minneapolis, and the next sort of 95th percentile, as it were, is more heavily tilted toward St. Paul. And for a variety of reasons, the school district's population that they intend to serve is all relatively the same. But on this very, very fine dicing on the measures, a percentage or two can make a big difference. And so the two districts were behind the request, and their proposal essentially recognizes that there's that distinction by just a percentage or two, and then a number, large number clustered now that will be on the St. Paul side until it flips back to Minneapolis, but all relatively serving the same number of low-income children.
And just a little clarification.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be for Mr. Strom. So my overall question is current law, which I think is looking at students and awarding, making sure our lowest income students are most eligible. That's the current law. Correct. And then this is an attempt to So I guess I don't quite understand if we're still if we're still serving based upon order of need. Why do we need this change? And as Chair Pinto said, it's been around for a number of years, and yet I'm not clear to understand why we need to change the current law if the current law is awarding these. These aren't necessarily. Can't tell that they're scholarships, but it's VPK, so it's not scholarships. But so we're always have, stretched resources, challenging resources. We usually try and target resources to those most in need. So what's the reason to do this?
Well, Madam Chair, it's certainly a policy decision for this committee to consider. I think the argument the two districts would put forth is if Minneapolis has a building at 95% and at 94% and at 94 or 93.75%, and then St. Paul has seven buildings from 93% down to 88%, and Minneapolis's next building is at 87%. That you're still talking about relatively the same level of poverty at all of those schools. Two lists essentially would accommodate each district's both sort of geographic reasons for their buildings being slightly different in that balance. But it's certainly not a research question so much as a policy question about whether that should be two regions or one.
Representative Pinto?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's described in an extremely, I think, a really well-done way. And I think it's important to emphasize that the same, there wouldn't bring any additional dollars into Minneapolis-St. Paul districts than would be coming in at all, right? The issue is that rather than having them be combined in one, which can have some pernicious effects as described by Mr. Strom, that instead it recognizes that there's quite high poverty school sites in both of these districts, and so that's where the districts came forward and said, we do want to make sure that the high poverty sites are being both addressed, as opposed to the way that the statistics work out is that actually it ends up being disproportionately one way versus the other, when that really wouldn't have been the intent. But there's no new dollars coming into the districts as a result of this. And again, both the House and Senate did approve this as part of what was done and voted for last spring, too.
And Representative Pinto, help me just understand, as I think about this, we divide the state up into four regions currently to avoid kind of absurd distributional effects. This just says 4A and 4B.
Yes, you absolutely are, yeah. And to confirm, it's not like this goes from four regions to five and then thereby the other regions gets proportionally less. I mean, it really is. It's that one region gets split in two to make sure that there's an equitable allocation within those two districts, but no additional drawing from any other parts of the state. Yeah. But
just as we make sure that the inner ring suburbs in greater Minnesota have access to equitable access to these resources.
That's correct, Mr.
Chair. Thank you.
Senator Nelson?
Thank you. And just a follow-up, I appreciate the oftentimes this comes right at the end of session and we don't get a full discussion on this, so let's take advantage of this moment in time. So my, and it's also interesting because both Minneapolis and St. Paul, as I understand it, are advocating for this change. And so then do we, and first of all, the way it works, so currently is the issue that because of the way the poverty levels are in the individual schools, that Minneapolis is seeing more VPK funding, and this particular change is an effort to make sure that it's more equitable so that some additional, because it's the same pot of money, the same amount of money, so that more schools in St. Paul are served. Is that the intent?
Mr.
Chair, Madam Chair, I think the issue is that because of the relatively unevenness at the very top of that distribution, the order essentially went Minneapolis, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and now there's going to be a whole bunch. There's like one more Minneapolis if you were to go further down the list, and then be a whole bunch of St. Pauls in a row, and both districts have suggested that they would much rather be able to essentially take their relative population share of that and determine which programs within on their poverty list make the most sense. So it's, but like I say, that's sort of a policy matter for you to decide whether there should be four regions or five, whether there should be any regions or all is sort of a policy decision.
Thank you. And then just a further question. So we currently have four regions in the state, and my question is, are there any other similarly situated regions where we may be setting a precedent? And I don't know if you can identify where those might be, but I think that's an important point for us to note here as well.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, in the four regions are a charter school region, is the first of those four regions, and so all of the charter schools are in one region. Then the greater Minnesota region, if you look at the distribution list there, it tends to be throughout greater Minnesota, but particularly those communities that are near an Indian reservation or on an Indian reservation are toward the very high end of the list, and then some of the communities that have egg processing facilities are very high on the list as well. But those in the rural region are split. If you were to look at sort of a pinpoint map of them, you'd see them, I think, all around the state. In the suburban area, it's not entirely clear how one might split the suburban region. Certainly there's various concentrations. If one were to look at an inner and outer ring suburb, one might see that split treating those districts differently. And then there's sort of a question of how the third tier exurban areas sort of line up with the greater Minnesota regions just across the way. But in general, as you get into that third ring suburban area, there doesn't tend to be too many sites that would qualify regardless how you slice the regions, whether they're in their own sort of non-central, non-inner ring suburb or a different one. They'd probably be relatively low on the list. We have a list we'd be happy to provide showing the rankings of the schools in each region. The one issue when we show it on a building level, there's it's about a 30-page list for the 2,000 buildings, but we'd be very glad to bring a list down just so you could see both the relative percentages and how precipitous the drop is in some areas and how closely clustered they are in other areas. So,
and then you could just put it on a map for us, and that would be very easy and helpful too. But no, in all seriousness, though, so I think this is only for growth in VPK. Is that correct?
Mr. Strong?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, yes, there's another provision in VPK that says once you're a qualified site, you remain a qualifying site. So if there were growth is when this would come into play.
Yeah, so this thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Strong. So this would assuming that there's growth in VPK.
Mr. Trump?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, it would only have effect should there be growth in VPK. Yes.
Thank you. And then my last question is, so if I understand the discussion, there'd be one region for all the charter schools and then two regions for the Twin Cities and then two regions for the rest of the state.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And the way the overall portion of the funding is derived is based on the number of pupils in each of those regions. So if it's a small region with fewer pupils, it gets a smaller chunk of the overall target, and then that's distributed within that region. So if the suburban region, for example, were 45% of the enrollment statewide, 45% of the money would go toward them. If the charter school region were 6% of the state total ADM, then the charter school region would get 6% of the VPK funding and so forth. And if Minneapolis and St. Paul combined are about 9%, instead of them getting 9% of the state total, they'd get each of the two would then get 4.5% of the total or thereabouts.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think if I'm understanding that right, then if the state was all one region, because of the higher poverty in Minneapolis and St. Paul, those cities would in fact get more funding, I think, if they weren't separated off based on the regions, based on size. That's a little bit dangerous for me to say that, but I think that's correct.
I'm looking at Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, yes.
So Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, it's actually protective of the rest of the state, because otherwise there'd be more funding going to Minneapolis and St. Paul by having them be off in their own region. It actually means there's actually less proportionally because of the poverty levels.
And this allows the higher, lower income sites in both cities to be served more equitably.
Correct. Of the pool, Mr. Chair, of the pool that already exists and that is smaller than it would be proportionally because it's just based on population rather than poverty in terms of being broken up. So, and again, it has been voted for too as well.
All right. Thank you.
And thank you for the good discussion. And just a final clarifier, I was not at all indicating there should be one region.
No.
My question is, do we need two regions in Minneapolis-St. Paul, and then two regions to cover the rest of the state. That was kind of more like the genesis of my question. Yeah. Not that there be no regions. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions on this provision from members? Seeing none, Ms. Pera.
Yes.
Background studies, am I right?
Sure, yes. And these are also in Article 8, Sections 12 and 13, so if you'll turn to page R12. These both relate to background checks. Section 12 relates to tribal organizations and Section 13 to Head Start programs. And it's allowing these organizations or programs to contract with Department of Human Services for their background studies.
And is Ms. Pera, is this permissive they may or directive they must?
Mr. Chair, these are both may contract with DHS to do this, and both of these were in the 2018 bill as well.
Hmm. Thank you. Questions, members?
I may just
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe this may be more in the Head Start provision, but I know that these are both very, very important provisions for those who are doing this work, and certainly for Head Start to be able to continue doing so, just in terms of that stakeholder perspective. I think that's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
No questions.
Interested in moving to some adoption?
Before
dinner?
Mr. Chair?
Madam Chair.
I will be glad to take these back and talk about some of these things. We've had good discussion today. I know some of us have an appointment at 5 o'clock tonight. If we might be able to recess and hopefully do a couple things, get to where I think we can have some good conversations, but then also meet with my conferees. And so if we can recess, I think that would be, this might be a good point to do that.
My understanding is that your side also brought a list of topics from my conversation with Mr. Marcus.
Yes.
Why don't we, since the party doesn't start till 5, and I was taught that it was tacky to show up before the party was scheduled to start, you usually catch the host not quite dressed and maybe their hair's still wet. Can we...
That'd be kind of fun.
I'm not sure about the not quite dressed part.
Oh,
I think we've had some pretty clear discussions in the legislature about that recently.
Something about the wet hair. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
The wet hair is not my concern.
Okay.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair and members, we have these... in front of you, three really technical corrections that are in the Senate description, and we can have staff just go over those starting in Article 1.
Certainly. Mr. Arneson, please.
Mr. Chair and members, of the three items on the list, one is in Article 1 on page R29. This is a provision, I believe, that was in the 2018 bill as well. And it's purely technical in the sense that it strikes some obsolete language relating to a reimbursement aid for special ed litigation costs that is no longer available, long repealed. And we're just striking this cross-reference.
Aid for, Mr. Arneson, that's the aid for litigation on
that's correct.
21.2 on the Senate side? Mm-hmm. All right.
The next item.
Mr. Arneson, if you can pause for a moment, please. Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. Arneson.
The next item is in Article 2 on page R51. Earlier this week, the committee adopted a repealer of Section 123A26, Subdivision 3, which is authority for a school district to request aid payment to a third party. And probably at that same time, the committee may have also wanted to adopt this provision here, which is simply striking a reference to that section now repealed.
All right.
This would be purely technical relative to the committee's earlier actions.
Thank you.
And the last item on the list in front of you is in Article 8, the early childhood article, on page R5. This is a Senate-only provision that requires a school district enrolling voluntary pre-kindergarten pupils to record those expenditures according to guidelines prepared by the commissioner under Section 127A17. Members may know that the commissioner provides some guidance to districts in terms of their accounting practices in the UFARS system and the UFARS manual. There is it's an object code in or maybe I'm getting that word wrong, but there's a code in UFARS for VPK expenditures, and this provision on the Senate side would make clear, reinforce that existing requirement to record VPK expenditures according to these guidelines.
Representative Pinto?
I do have a question relating to that. How common is it that districts are not using those mm-hmm. guidelines? Or just can we get a little more insider context on that?
Mr. Chair and members, when the Senate inquired for data about VPK expenditures, I mean, we know what the revenues are because those are kind of distributed on the formula. When the Senate inquired about what districts are actually spending, assuming that there may be some other unreserved general dollars being spent in this way, we found that the data are actually quite noisy and incomplete. Mm-hmm. And it was the Senate's position that Senator Nelson, it would be better for Senator Nelson to indicate why we thought this was important to codify.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it's always good to know what those expenses are and what those revenues are. One, we need to know. Secondly, we want to know what's working where. And I was a little surprised to find out that we just don't really know what those expenses are. And so using the financial accounting that our school districts use for other expenditures, I think would help us better understand what those expenses are, how to better plan for them, how to prioritize so that we're investing in things that are working. So it just seemed to me that it was a good, a good government provision.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a couple follow-up questions. So this provision requires that expenses be recorded according to the guidelines. Is there a separate requirement that those records then be reported to the department?
Mr. Arneson?
Mr. Chair, members, the way it works out is that the districts record their expenditures in the UFAR system, and that system is hosted by the department. Data in that system is accessible to members or staff who ask for statewide records of expenditures. And so there's no specific reporting requirement other than what's already required generally of districts relative to the entire UFAR system.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. So then what about the other expenses that districts have? Are they all required to be recorded in the UFARS system other than VPK expenses?
Mr. Arneson.
Mr. Chair, members, I think it's fair to say that virtually every penny that a district spends would be recorded in the UFARS system in some code.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the thing that I'm struggling with is, or just trying to figure out is, If there's a general requirement that every penny be recorded, which makes sense, then I guess I'm confused about why that general requirement wouldn't encompass VPK. If it doesn't encompass VPK, then maybe there's not a general requirement, but then maybe we should be doing it for other expenses than VPK. So I'm trying to, if you understand my logic, then I'm trying to work think through here.
Senator Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, actually, this is exactly why the proposal's in front of us. I think it's just one of these, another example where our laws are trying to keep up with current developments. Okay. So I'm assuming that the UFARs, as it was rolled out, we didn't have VPK. So I think it's just a matter of, again, keeping our laws current.
Just quick
follow-up. Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand, and that seems like it seems good. I guess I'm still trying. So I have the UFAR statute, which is 127A.17. It's referenced in the right in the in this yep. provision here. It is as I'm still trying to struggle a little bit or understand why we should need it for this specific expense. And I understood that you've asked, and we don't have those expenses. Then it makes me wonder what other things are we not asking about and then not having the records of, which maybe says we should just have a general requirement that everything be in there. So anyway, all right, I guess I'll drop that.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if our discussion is concluded yet, but it might be worth noting that I just received a notice that we're back in session at 6.
Yes.
So...
Yes.
It was your turn, Rep. Erdahl. Excuse me. Mic drop.
Yes. Gravity. Mr. Arneson, that completed the three items that the Senate brought forward tonight. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, those were the three items on that list, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. So, members, as Representative Erdahl indicated, the House is reconvening at 6 o'clock. To consider messages from the Senate. Both sides have indicated an interest in caucusing the provisions that have been discussed. So I'm told not to hit the gavel for recesses.
Oh, good to know.
It throws off the folks doing the tape. But we stand in recess to call the chair approximately 7 o'clock. Thank you very much. Welcome back, everyone. The tape is on. The handouts have been delivered to members. We'll take a moment and let the increasingly diminishing public in the room pick up a copy of the document entitled Items for Discussion, Wednesday, May 15, 7 p.m. So, Senator Nelson, what we did is put together one comprehensive list of the discussion items to simplify our work and for, you know, folks following along at home, and thought we would just work our way through this, unless you have something else.
Yes.
Senator Nelson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have a proposal for you.
Okay.
That builds upon what we did today.
Very good.
And so we would like to pass that out.
Thank you. As these go around, Senator, do yes. any of these, because I'm not quite fast enough, do any of these impact the items that are on the sheet we just distributed?
Well,
are these amendments too? Are these in addition to? I just need some clarity there.
This is the first time I've seen this particular sheet, if it's different than the one we had when we left here today at 2 p.m.
This is the sheet titled Wednesday, May 15 is 7 p.m. is items that we discussed earlier today.
Okay. So
nothing
same,
more, nothing
same,
less.
Same. Okay, wonderful. So there are some similarities and some not. So if you'd like, we can go over the – there's three Senate items that
Well, why don't – just to keep everybody in the loop here,
yeah.
So Senator Nelson, why don't you go over the seven items so that we're all up to speed
yeah.
– and yep. can track
with that. Yep. So we can just track them all together. Mr. Anderson, I'll have you go over those seven items, telling members where they are and just a brief thing about what they do. I believe the first three are just technical in nature, but they are all some Senate and some House provisions.
Okay. And to be clear for everyone, this document is titled, excuse me, Items Proposed by Senate for Adoption, May 15, 2019, 7 p.m. So, Mr. Arnes.
Mr. Chair, all seven items on the Senate sheet are also contained on the sheet that the House distributed. So,
oh, all right.
You can think of the Senate proposal here as a subset of the items on the House sheet. But just to make it clear for members, items one and two on the Senate sheet are the first two items on the House sheet. These are the striking language to aid programs or provisions already repealed by items the committee has adopted. The third item on the Senate sheet corresponds with row number 194 on the House sheet, the maltreatment of minors and the clarification of what information has to be provided by the commissioner. Item number four on the Senate sheet corresponds with row number 286 on the House sheet, financial accounting, increasing the visibility of a district's requirement to record VPK expenditures in the UFAR system.
Mm-hmm.
Item number five on the Senate sheet corresponds with row number 282. This is age-appropriate instruments from the House side. Item number six corresponds with row 295 on the House sheet, background study of tribal organizations. And item number seven corresponds with row 296 on the House side, the background study for the Head Start programs.
And so, if I'm clear, these are proposals for approval, there's no amendments, there's no changes to language being proposed here.
Yeah. Mr.
Senator Nelson.
That's correct. We took the good work that we did today,
mm-hmm.
and we're able to propose adopting some of those provisions, and then, actually, I think they all were from today, and so we have seven provisions.
So of the other provisions we looked at today, original row numbers, since we're using those as one point of reference, I'm looking at the 1 p.m. document here. Those dealing with administration of drugs and medicine, both applicability and the unclaimed drugs for medication.
I have the 7 p.m. document and a 2 p.m. document. I don't see one that says 1 o'clock. Help me out here. Let's all be looking at the right same thing.
Sure. Well, so if we go to the 7 p.m. document.
Okay.
Now I've got to find my copy of it.
shortage of paper.
If we go to the 7 p.m. document, they're the third and fourth on the list after the two Senate items. Again, since we're using these original row numbers as one point of reference, lines 233 and 234, the one allowing requiring a parent of a student, I believe, to pick up leftover drugs, whether it's the end of a year or a prescription that is no longer applicable to the student or whatever it may be. And then line 234, which deals with unclaimed drugs, and particularly unclaimed drugs, depending on differentiates how they're handled based on class.
And in your question, is
Looking to see if your interest on that. I see it's not on your 7 p.m. list.
Yep.
It is areas that we would like to just move along as we try to get some work done while our leaders do whatever it is our leaders are doing.
Yes. And so we're not ready to move on those pieces, but we do have seven provisions in front of us that we're ready to move on. I think there are perhaps three Senate provisions and four mm-hmm. House provisions. Mm-hmm.
Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Madam Chair, since these are policy provisions, just wondering if there's any more information that you need. They're pretty clear that if just school just this was in the proposal last year that you guys already voted on, if districts are running into this issue where folks need to come either pick up their drugs or that they have to have a way to dispose of them legally instead of having them stay at the school. So just need to know if you need more information on it. Nope. That what or what changed your mind since last year.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Chair Youakim, we do, you know, we're sad that the governor vetoed these things last year, but we had to start from scratch. Unfortunately, that's what happens with a new legislative session and a veto. And so we are just, we're not ready to move on these yet. But Chair Youakim, I do not need any more information.
Okay. So just to be clear,
Representative Youakim,
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, you're not ready to move on them because you have to start back from scratch because you're upset that bill was vetoed last year.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair. Chair Youakim, no one said anything about being upset. I'm just stating that this is a new session, a new year, and bills from previous sessions do not carry over.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Youakim.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I misspoke. You said you were disappointed. Thank you.
All right. Discussion to the document items proposed by Senate for adoption May 15, 2019, 7 p.m.
And the Mr. Chair and the Senate conferees have had a we discussed the House provisions mm-hmm. this afternoon, and the Senate conferees did obviously discuss the Senate provisions. So.
Certainly. Seeing none, Senator Nelson, would you like to move? I'm trying to do this in a coherent fashion, I guess, if you just want to move through them one at a time.
Sure. Or I can move the Senate provisions.
Yes, that's what we can sure. At this time work off of. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there was one other provision that was in the veto bill last year mm-hmm. that was not that's not in the list of seven, which is the one regarding the splitting up of that VBK zone into both one into Minneapolis and one into St. Paul. I just want to, I guess maybe a similar question, is there some information that the Senate is waiting for, or does it kind of fall in the same category as those other two provisions?
So this was an effort on the House part, and actually bicamerally last year, to make sure that the lowest income children in both of those cities get treated equally. And so, Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And we had a good discussion on this today, too. I thought a very, very extensive discussion. And those are not on our adoption list for this evening.
Mm-hmm. Would you? Oh, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe go in the same direction as you were going to go, which is just to find out. Similarly, is there additional information that the Senate is looking for, or does it kind of fall in the same category of those other two? Is just not ready to move on at this point, I'm guessing.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Pinto. Yes, we don't need any more information. We've even had more discussion today than I think we even had when we had these things in that omnibus bill last session that was vetoed. But then again, we're in a new session. We're starting from scratch. We've got new bills in front of us. We don't think we don't know that anything particularly has changed, but we do know that we have a lot of things that are different in our bills, and we're going to need to, as soon as we get some direction from our leaders, we're going to have to look at what do those global bills look like.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe with respect, I'll point out that because these aren't tied to budget, to funding, I guess my thought, at least, and perhaps those of some of my colleagues as well, were thinking that these are provisions that are in the current House bill, which was passed by a DFL majority, but had been voted on and approved by both a Republican House majority, Republican Senate majority in the past. And so I think we were kind of viewing all of these provisions as kind of being part of a package as a set that kind of fell into that category of having been passed in support. Understood that was a past session. But I think part of the thinking is that I will admit that I'm looking at this thinking, boy, there's going to be a lot of work we're going to have to do. And And so wouldn't it be nice if we could move forward on those things that have the received past support from both GOP members and DFL members, which is true of all of these provisions. So we obviously can't force the anybody into anything, but the hope would be that kind of with all of these, they have received past support, because at this point now received support recently from a House DFL vote, but received previous support from a GOP Senate vote, GOP House vote. And so I don't know if we could possibly, just to sort of appeal to our Senate colleagues, the thought that we can at least clear these out of the way, recognizing there's going to be plenty more to work on.
And Representative Pinto, of course, the House bill passed with bipartisan vote.
Good point. Yeah, right.
So GOP votes on this provision as well. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and Chair Dabney. The provisions in question now assume that there will be increases in VPK funding at this point. It is not clear that that's going to be the case, so it's a little bit premature. And as I said, the House has a bill that has a lot of spending and a lot of policy in it. The Senate bill is much more narrowly tailored. And as we go forward, which we hope we'll have some direction here soon, Chair Dabney, we're going to be looking at all of these things that we want to be able to address. So right now, it's just a little premature.
All right. So, Senator Nelson, do you have a motion for the body?
Oh, yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would move that we adopt Senate, it looks like Article 1, Section 26. And do you need any more discussion on that beyond what Mr. Arneson?
Well, let's ask. Let's ask.
Yeah.
Any discussion to the Nelson motion to adopt Senate Article 1, Section 26? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
The next one, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt Article 1, Section 27 of the Senate bill. It strikes a reference to payment authority, which was already repealed in Article 1.
All right. Any discussion to the Nelson motion? Seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. So we've done this. Okay. Let me just try to track. So the next item on the Senate agenda, let's see, or the... I'm just trying to...
Line 194 in your chart.
I've just got a couple of pieces of paper here that we're just trying to correlate everything. So I'm looking at another provision. Help me here, Representative Pinto, if you would. Line 282, the clarifying... that the cognitive and social skills formative measure administered to pre-kindergarten pupils under a voluntary pre-kindergarten, I think, is developmentally appropriate. Is that?
Yes,
Mr. Chair. That's, I believe that's the next item on the Senate's list.
Is that?
It's number five on the Senate list.
Number five on the Senate list.
Oh,
okay.
Right.
Okay. All right. Do you...
it's a House provision. Would you like to adopt that?
Certainly. Representative Pinto, do you want to move that one?
Are we doing the number three on the Senate's list, Mr. Chair, or number an article?
I think five on the Senate list.
Okay. In that case, Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of House Article 8, Section 3, which is on page R1-A8.
Any discussion to the Pinto motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Mm-hmm.
So, Chair,
yes,
we can go,
Senator Nelson.
We can go in two orders here, whichever you wish.
That's the problem.
Just let me know which one to choose. We can either go sequentially through this, or we can go through sequentially through this one. And it, if you want to stick to the 7 p.m. one, I'll be glad to move line 286.
We've got two 7 p.m. ones. So why don't we go to the number three on the Senate list?
Yes. Okay. So and that is a House provision.
Yes. Representative Joachim, do you want to move number three on the Senate list, or also known as line 194 on the House discussion list? Sure. It's R47A3, Article 3.
Just want to make sure I'm looking at the right stuff here. R47A3, Article 3, Section 58, are we looking at?
That's correct, regarding maltreatment of minors.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I would move House Article 3, Section 58 for adoption.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the Joachim motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt Senate Article 8, Section 2. This has to do with financial accounting. We spoke briefly about this afternoon, requiring a school district or charter school to record expenditures attributable to voluntary pre-K programs according to the UFARS system.
Thank you very much. We've got the motion before us. Ms. Snyder, since this is accounting, and I've just never been good at that. or Dr. Melcher, would you clarify this and give the committee some understanding of the UFARS system as it applies to tracking VPK expenditures?
Mr. Chair, Ms.
Snyder.
Melcher would probably be most helpful in this conversation.
Dr. Melcher, please.
Mr. Chair and members, when voluntary pre-kindergarten was established, beginning in fiscal year 2017, we amended the UFARS manual to include program code 200, which is used to track expenditures for voluntary pre-kindergarten. What we found with UFARS is that the more we use something, especially if we use it to calculate state aids, we get good data, and if we don't use things quite so much, we don't always get the best data. And this particular expenditure code is one that's not used to drive aid, because voluntary pre-K is based on a pupil unit formula primarily, rather than an expenditure reimbursement formula like CTE. I believe the Senate requested some data. Caitlin was just showing me the runs that we did. We showed about $19 million, I believe, in expenditures that districts recorded in program code 200, which is less than what the amount of funding was, so I presume there were some districts that may have used an old program code. For example, there's a code for general elementary instruction. So I have no doubt that all of the expenditures that school districts made for voluntary pre-kindergarten are recorded in UFARS. The issue gets to be at what level of granularity are the school districts reporting that, and so some districts may have reported some expenditures in elementary education rather than in voluntary pre-K. So districts are already required to report the information. We give them instructions to do that. I think probably having some specific language in law reminding districts that that's a priority for the legislature might help to improve reporting in the future, and certainly the department can send out additional information reminding districts that they should be using that program code, whether or not there's a change in the legislation. So we do have a process in place for districts to report this information. It's a relatively new code, and most districts appear to be using the code, but there may be some that haven't quite caught up to the process yet.
Questions from committee members?
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Who?
Oh.
Yeah. Sorry.
My apologies. I was looking around the committee table. Ms. Snyder.
Caitlin Snyder, Minnesota Department of Education. Just to add a little bit more information to what Dr. Melcher just said, there's also a second tab of the spreadsheet that was provided to members and staff that details the School Readiness Plus expenditures, which totals about $500,000 that was tracked appropriately in UFARS.
Thank you. Hearing no questions, Senator Nelson has moved Senate Article 8, Section 2. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Then, Representative Pinto?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Article 8, Section 12 for adoption. I believe we already adopted Section 3, so.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, it's just, which sheet did I note it on? All right, so, Pinto motion, moving House Article 8, Section 12.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
And what do those two provisions do?
Representative Pinto?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, the Section 12 is the background study relating to tribal organizations. The one coming up will be the background study relating to Head Start programs. It authorizes these organizations and Head Start as well in the next section to work with DHS to conduct background studies so we can be sure that people who are working with those kids are safe to do so.
Senator Nelson?
The Senate has urged adoption of these House proposals.
With that, all those in favor of adoption of House Article 8, Section 12, the Pinto motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then finally, Mr. Chair, I move adoption of House File Article, House Article 8, pardon me, Section 13 for adoption.
And this deals with background checks for Head Start.
That's exactly right, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the Pinto motion?
We just believe these are important. I understand our Head Start will not be able to proceed if we don't get these background checks done. I only can hope that they are done according. I'm sure they will be, but sometimes when background checks are required, they're pretty particular on how they're required. I know we've had some issues in the past. Sometimes that's another story for another time.
Okay.
But I'm sure that these have been well vetted and will be the background studies that are needed.
All right. With that, all those in favor of the Pinto motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. So, Senator Nelson, looking at the House sheet, items for discussion Wednesday, May 15, 7 p.m., we've got two provisions here. Numbers from lines 8 and 9, they're separated because of a formatting hiccup, I think, on this sheet. One dealing with absence from school for religious observance, the other going to school districts and allowing them to consider religious holidays. Freedom of religion, of course, being kind of the first freedom. We put a value on respecting the religious observance of students in the absence from school, recognizing that students will not be present at school because of religious holidays. And then the other, making sure that districts understand that they have the latitude to align their school calendar to reflect, I guess I would say, the religious observance of students in their district. And I'm wondering if the Senate would consider adoption of those and support our students in their religious expression.
Chair Dabney, the Senate's not prepared to make those adoptions tonight.
Senator Nelson, can you elaborate on that? We had, I think, Representative Ukin, you had some rich discussion on these provisions in your committee. Can you share some of that?
Yes, we did. They passed overwhelmingly in our committee. They actually... had a rabbi, a mom, and a pastor come in and talk about how important it is to make sure that local control and school boards are listening to their local community and their religious needs. So this was just some comfort language the schools would like, even though a lot of it is already required. But it's sometimes nice to have those belts and suspenders in mm-hmm. statute. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, Senator Nelson?
We don't have any questions about that, just waiting for kind of to look at a more global picture of all the things that we are going to be accepting at some point mm-hmm. as from both bills as we go forward. And we do know that the Senate has looked at things like flexible learning year, mm-hmm. which does allow districts to determine when they would like to, what they think their school calendar should look like. Mm-hmm. So there's many ways, I think, to address that, but I really appreciate the focus on local control mm-hmm. with our local school mm-hmm. districts, being able to determine what these school calendars look like. And, of course, we always want to. Our country was founded on religious freedom, and I don't think that's ever – we never want to see that go away.
That's right.
So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Youakim.
Madam Chair, I know you and I have had a lot of great discussion about flexible learning, and that, in fact, I had not known a lot about it until I talked to you, so I do appreciate that. But that's almost like a business model that a district would have to change and go through MDE. This goes more to the heart of the school board being able to listen to their – school district when they set the calendars, and most of the districts are already setting the calendars 1 or 2 years out right now. Mm-hmm. So the sooner we can do this, I think the better.
Senator Nelson?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Youakim. Actually, the Senate proposal did not say, the Senate proposal said it was a school board decision. Current law states that it is an MDE decision.
Yes.
So yes, the Senate provision would allow districts to choose to make those calendar decisions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Youakim.
Madam Chair, I believe there was an amendment on the floor that stripped that out.
Is that provision in the bill as it comes to this committee, Senator Nelson?
Chair Dabney and Chair Youakim, no, the Senate was a bit, shall I say, confused, thinking, and I say this bipartisanly, getting the flexible learning year confused with what happened on the House floor. So we literally had Senate members standing up reading letters of opposition to the flexible learning year that were not in opposition to the flexible learning year, but were in opposition to the pre-Labor Day start bill that had been heard on the House floor. So there was a certain amount of confusion that certainly exacerbated a number of issues with that, and some of the advocacy groups that wrote letters in opposition to the pre-Labor Day start were astounded and quite shocked that their letter had been taken over to the Senate and used to argue against the flexible learning year when they had no such position. So let us just say there's been a fair amount of a confusion about that.
Well, I think we've all had that experience of advocacy groups misrepresenting what's in a bill. We've had a fair amount of that with our bill.
Yeah, actually, Mr. Chair, no, just let me it was not the advocacy groups misrepresenting. It was members misrepresenting what the advocacy letter said. But could have been no fault there. Easy mm-hmm. to get confused in the mm-hmm. light of amendments that happen quickly mm-hmm. and all that happened. So certainly, but at this point, the Senate is not ready to move on the calendaring.
Representative Youakim.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, just so I'm clear so I can find it in the language and look at it, yeah. I had watched the proceedings and the amendment did go on. So could you show me in our side-by-sides where that language is then if it wasn't taken off on the Senate floor?
Oh.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I think so. Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, no, I told you the amendment was adopted, did take out the language, but the arguments were based upon something that had happened over in the House on a different bill.
Madam Chair, I totally feel your pain on that.
Yeah.
There you go.
So there we go.
So,
yeah,
got
exactly.
it. Thank you for clearing that up.
Yeah. Representative Verdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's a good discussion on flexible learning and start dates and all that. I just wanted to to note in case the Senate wasn't aware that the House did take a strong bipartisan position in favor of the post-Labor Day start.
Mm-hmm. Which is why the language on religious observance is so important, because we've got once every 25-year, roughly, alignment with the post-Labor Day start, and I'm going to say Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah.
Rosh Hashanah.
So I would say the school calendar remains very important for all, and I have visited with my Jewish friends and constituents who have made that very clear to me as well, so it is not lost in the conversation.
Okay. Very good. Okay. So, Senator, what are we doing tomorrow?
Well, Mr. Chair, we hope some great work gets done this evening, and we should have a lot to do tomorrow.
Absent that. Under the headlines of things that we can control.
True. We are planning to commence the conference committee at 2:00 tomorrow.
Okay.
And if perhaps we have great news before then, you and I can get together and look at that good news and see how to progress. But we think 2:00 will be a time where we have some sort of direction and have had time to hopefully do some action in regards to that direction should we get that. So we will be convening at 2:00 tomorrow.
Okay. Any other questions before we adjourn for the evening? Hearing none, members, thank you for your service today. Good night. We are adjourned.